Thank you. So this evening, the purpose of this work session is, some of you may have seen Bob come before you and go over the vacant buildable lands model. For some of you that are new, this is the model that we use for planning purposes. We use it to estimate, based on the comp plan designation, single family or land for rooftops and land for jobs, how much of that I've developed, what is vacant to develop, and we use that to estimate what is the capacity in the urban growth boundary. So the assumptions built into the model and the mechanics of the model, changes are made to the model based on facts, if you will. So this is more like evidence-based model, and changes made to the model are made based on actual facts. And it's only the council that makes changes to the model. And we seek input from the public and our city partners before changes are made to the model. So Bob Poole is the county GIS manager. The model is hosted by them and maintained by our GIS staff. For planning, we just go to them and say, run the model and give us the information. We share that with the cities and then get their input, make changes, or based on their input, we use that to finally make decision on when to release the actual run based on whatever year. So with that, let me turn it over to Bob Poole, who is going to walk you through the model, why we use it, how we use it. And we have had, what I would say, about 23 years history in using the model. So I'm sure you will have questions as we proceed, but I would say, you know, you can reserve your question or you can ask it as Bob goes through. There are areas where we may not be able to get you the type of answers that you're looking for, and that may be how much have we really absorbed in terms of lands that are vacant on a year-by-year basis. But Bob has a story map that he can tell you so that you can see areas that we said made an assumption that won't develop based on maybe environmental constraints. He can show you over time how those areas have developed and what the yields are. So with that, let me turn it over to Bob, Bob Poole. Thank you.
Turn some of these lights down. Is this these work?
So this has been a really exciting year for me working on the vacant buildable lands model, because we have gotten direction from the state to start truing the model up. How accurate is it based on reality? So I've really been looking at playing with finding that out and finding new ways to share the data online. So it's actually been a pretty fun year. So like Oliver says, I'm going to talk about how the model works and work into some of these analysis things I've been playing with and the new ways of viewing the maps and reports up in the cloud that we've released this year. So really the purpose of the vacant buildable lands model is to meet the requirements of the Growth Management Act, which is really to understand how much additional capacity there is out in the rural area. So, or out in the UGA, excuse me. It identifies the vacant and buildable land inside the UGA. It's pretty clear. Provides a measure of remaining capacity of jobs and people. And like Oliver said, we've saved up 23 years of these, so we're really starting to see some trends and issues that we can address. How does it work? As Oliver said, it's pretty straightforward. We've worked with criteria, has been settled on by the cities, the county, and the community with their input during the comprehensive planning process. We use our GIS system to do the modeling, and that's got a programming language in it called Python that we use to develop this. We also use the best available layers, which are GIS map layers and the assessor's database. We also have a feedback loop in our map layers and with the assessor to clean up the data to try and improve the model over time. How's that work? The GIS allows us to overlay layers, map layers, and combine them, combine their database tables behind the scenes. So we look at the parcel layer, the comprehensive plan, wetlands. We look at assessor's data, bring it all together, and do a big query and kind of classify things. It's pretty straightforward in some ways. It's a lot of data, and there's a lot of years to it, so it gets to be big data with a lot of noise in it. The way it basically works is we start out talking with the cities, and they submit a comprehensive plan that they say is going to be their plan for development for the next 20 years. We take that detailed comprehensive plan and aggregate things down into the land use classifications that the vacant buildable land model understands. We can add to those, but currently that's the set that there is. Then the VBLM is run over those land use classifications. What we do is the VBLM land use classifications that come from the comprehensive plan define which model it runs in. So what model you're in decides the criteria for vacant and buildable. It also says if you've got a mixed-use property, how much of that goes to residential, how much do you want to put in commercial. The assumptions for gross to net, so if we get a gross vacant acre, how many net acres is that and how many houses is it going to be? And then, again, how many jobs per net acre of vacant land? So it's pretty, that's about all it does. So to walk through that, here's the comprehensive plan that Battleground submitted. And you can see the detail in here. You can see the red is commercial. Different shades of red are different types of commercial. Yellow and orange are different types of residential. And blues are industrial. Now, when we look at the comprehensive plan designations that Battleground gave us, you can see on the right, here's the detailed one. Here's how we aggregate them into the VBLM land uses. And then here's the actual model that it runs in. And you can see things like, you know, if they have an urban medium density residential zone, it just gets lumped into the high density here because there is no high density. All the commercial gets lumped into the single commercial class. And you can see the mixed use. And these are the Battleground ones. There's a few more that they use in other cities, but this gives you an idea of how it works. You can see things like parks and open space, public facilities. They have no corresponding part in the VBLM because there's no jobs. There's no housing in there. They just get ignored by the model. This is pretty crucial as to how the model works, that we take that comprehensive plan and aggregate it into these pieces. So looking at Battleground now, you can see it's a lot simpler. All the commercials, one color red. Well, it's two. It's the commercial and then the mixed use. You can see the residential is also consolidated down into those classifications.
So that was after you aggregate everything down?
That's right. I take the comprehensive plan, and we go to the land use classifications, which looks like that. Then we go to the model, aggregates it one more step, and this shows you how I run them through the three models. Does that make sense?
Excellent. Can you remind me, Albert, we were talking about public facilities, and we had that on schools.
If you go back to two more slides, see around here public facilities. In the model, it doesn't.
It doesn't take it into consideration.
They're excluded. They're not buildable.
What's that?
They are excluded.
Schools are excluded.
Yep.
Yes.
Don't they produce jobs?
We have a different category.
That was my question. Schools produce jobs. So.
Yes, we include a bunch of public sector jobs. And we'll get to that point.
Good question. That's
good question. Parks are also taken out or not included in the model. So even if you have a property that is zoned for parks, we don't assign any value to that. So that is already taken out of the model. And that's why sometimes we have conversation on how much set aside for parks, but we know where they are. They're not included in the model. The same is true for schools, because often we work in the school districts where they identify sites that they want to come inside the urban growth boundary. So when they do that, and we bring that property inside the urban growth boundary, we don't see any need to designate another acreage or account for another acreage for schools.
think there's an important thing about the vacant lands model, too, is it's looking for additional capacity. So if we were to find some vacant school land, you're saying there's going to build a school on it. And at this point, we say if there's vacant school land out there, we're going to ignore it anyway because we don't know what they're going to do with it.
So I have a question. So these four categories that are left here, is that all the category options after you funnel it down, or is that just what came up from Battleground?
So what this does, this is Battleground. So there are more comprehensive plan designations, and there's actually some more VBLM land use classifications. Okay. I'm just showing you the general trend.
That was my question, yeah.
By getting into the models, it really affects how I select what the vacant land is. That's really the key. As you get into your different model, I'm going to have different criteria, which is interesting from a current use perspective, right? Because some current, or excuse me, mixed use, some mixed use is in the commercial model, some mixed uses end up in the residential model. Which model it ends up in has a lot of impact on how many actual houses and jobs it's going to yield, the way the parameters work. So if we start down then, what is vacant? I'm getting right out there. In the residential model, vacant is building value less than $13,000. I think you'll agree that's vacant. That number was set in 2007, haven't changed it since. It's more vacant now than it used to be. That's the same with commercial and industrial. You can see the value is a little bit higher at 67,000. So again, if you've got a mixed-use parcel, if you're in the residential, you're going to show up vacant much faster than you are, much easier than you are in the commercial model. And this is what the vacant looks like in Battleground. You can see it's pretty evenly distributed, and again, it's color-coded by the different classes. The next thing we look at is what is underutilized. Underutilized says I've got some structure on there. There might be a house on a 5-acre or a 10-acre lot. We say the house can probably put some more houses on there or tear down what's there and redevelop it. That's what underutilized is. It's got to be a larger parcel. In the residential, it's a minimum 1-acre parcel. So you do not see much underutilized in the downtown area because all the parcels are way less than an acre. They've got to be in the bottom 10th percentile of building value per acre. So that's less than $534,000 in 2019. I remember if you have an acre of land and you can put six houses on it, right, that's what we're looking at versus you've got one house on there. So you can see where that building value per acre, where we get that is we look at all the residential houses inside the UGA and get the whole histogram of building value per acre on all those properties, and this is the bottom 10th percentile. So it is way at the end of the outliers almost there. Commercial, and this one's kind of cool because it resets every year, so it adjusts for inflation, and adjusts for as pressure drives home prices up, it's still going to say those underutilized properties are going to keep popping up. At the commercial industrial, the building value per acre is 50,000. There's no mechanism for changing that. So some of these things, if we don't put in a way of automatically incrementing these things, they sit there. Like the vacant cutoff and the building, the industrial one, they just don't move. They get a bit stale. This is the same underutilized for Battleground. It's kind of interesting. You see there's absolutely no underutilized in the Battleground core because there's no 1-acre parcels in there, right? So all we have downtown is going to be vacant, so we don't have much of a redevelopment thing going on there. So you can see it really starts to say these farm fields out here with a barn or something or an outbuilding are the ones that we're calling underutilized.
So can I ask, in the area that shows that there's no underutilized, what if there is a, for example, a piece of land that's down there that's zoned it's residential, they've got 60,000 square foot lots, but it's zoned for high density. Been rezoned by the city of Battleground. They rezoned it so you can do a higher density. Does it take any consideration, anything like that, with the zoning? So, no.
I showed you how it works. It's pretty simple. I think this is one of the challenges of how we do. I think underutilized is a nice concept, but we're struggling with redevelopment. And this combines, and you can see we still are finding some vacant land in downtown Battleground that can redevelop. This is the whole vacant and underutilized. As we start to move on, the difference between vacant and underutilized gets a little less meaning. You can start to forget about that because it becomes just vacant. So not vacant or underutilized, all of these things that we find, which is right-of-way parks, schools, public facilities, mansions, courtyards, we just throw these out because these are things that The community has said, do not redevelop. They do not develop, don't include them in the model. So we don't. So here's what the VBLM looks like for Battleground. And you can see the gray is the built stuff. And we've talked about the vacant already. The next thing that's important about the vacant land that we have is how fast does it develop? And develop rates of development, right? We've got a 20-year time frame to develop this stuff on. And what we say is market factors are that vacant land will develop faster than underutilized, right? It's shovel-ready sitting there, and we don't have to wait for someone to sell their house or decide they want to get rid of it. We say it sells, will develop faster. Some land will not develop within the 20-year plan. Again, someone owns the land, they don't want to sell it. That's a market factor. Policy factors and regulations, the environmental constraints, we've said they're unlikely to develop or going to have less development on them. And that's all the environmental constraints that are out there. Wetlands, steep slopes, endangered species, they all are in there. And these are the environmental constraints that we look at. And those are often GIS layers. They're the same GIS layers we use when people come in to get a building permit. And that's important because the environmental layers for building permits, we overstate them. If there's a stream, we buffer it because we know our streams aren't that accurate, so we make the area bigger. That flags the parcel to say, if you're going to build on it, you need an environmental specialist to come out and look for wetlands. We overstate it to get the review going on. When we look at the VBLM, we're still overstating it. So we're going to see some of it develop. So if you look at Battleground, these are all the environmental constraints, big green splot on there. You can see there's not much developable land in Battleground from that. And this really gets to be all of the vacant buildable lands criteria on one map. And what I've done is I've shaded all of the constrained stuff to make it darker. It actually gets kind of busy here when you've got the vacant and underutilized, the critical and the non-critical. So, if we look at underutilized versus vacant and constrained versus non-constrained, and this is when we start getting to the yield side of things, right? So, if I have a vacant piece of land, a gross acre of land, I'm going to say that this is the percentage that's deducted for being critical or constrained, this is the percentage that's never to develop, and this is the percentage that's deducted from infrastructure. And it's kind of stepwise. So I will take the amount that's taken away for constrained, 50% of that, and then it's vacant, so I'm going to take away never to develop 10%, and finally 30% of infrastructure. And you can see underutilized down here. Whew, you added those up, it's over 100%. But since it's stepwise, it works. And that gets us to our net acres, which is really good because you can have an underutilized constrained land and all these different combinations, but when you get to net, a net acre is a net acre. So then we can say those are apples to apples, right? Because we've done these deductions to make them equal. So in terms of following that through, if we had a parcel that was 100 acres of gross residential acres of vacant, it's going to give us 65 net acres. If it was underutilized and constrained, we're going to say only 25 of those acres are going to develop over the 20-year time frame. So you can see if I'm underutilized, I'm going to get a lot less houses on you than if I'm vacant. So there's a big difference between those two criteria, even though the criteria are what they are, I guess. Looking at that bigger in the Battleground case, you can see, holy cow, you've got a lot of underutilized, constrained, low-density land. That's your biggest thing you've comprehensive planned. But you can see this green part is the only, that's the amount of that's going to develop. Everything else here we're saying not going to develop because of our constraints. So you could say don't zone things in the constrained areas, but that's all we got. But we do say there's not much yield on that stuff versus your vacant, which is almost all yield, good dirt. Well, now we can start to look at the model through time, which is kind of having that 23 years of experience. This is what Battleground looked like in 2013, the last time I did that. And you can see I've gotten rid of the vacant and underutilized and just said everything's vacant to make the map a little clearer. And we're going to put the constrained on top because I think that's really important because people say constrained doesn't develop. And when you look at this and you see the built area in Battleground that are dark, those developed. So we do see constrained develop. What's really cool is up here, you see this constrained area here and the little green islands in the middle. So what they did was they built as close as they could. And then when it got seriously constrained, it turned into a greenway. You set it aside. So we do see that the critical lands are developing, and they also turn into wetlands. You also see the parks and battlegrounds. They land in the constrained areas. But large area constrained lands often turn into greenways and parks. So sometimes if we say infrastructure should include parks, well, the parks end up in the constrained lands. So if you're deducting them because they're constrained and you're setting them aside because they're parks, there's a real potential of double counting that land as being taken out. All right, now we can start seeing it. So this is what the UGA and battleground looked like way back in 1996. This dark line is the current UGA boundary, the 2013 one, you can see. And as we move through time here, you can start to see the ground getting munched on, turning to gray. Then you can see there was a UGA expansion there back in 2014. And there's the 27 expansion in 28. Down here, you can see there's a piece of land that went outside the UGA. That was actually remanded back in, so it was there, and then it went away. Boom, 2010. So, wow, that's what's happened over the last 23 years. It really is a pretty good indication of where things are developing. And it is working to some degree. All right, so now we want to look at some of these trends through time and starting to look at the VBLM forecast to actuals. And in this case, the actuals is the assessor's database. How many housing units are they find? How many housing units did you forget forecast? How many did the assessor get? This is some of the new stuff I've been doing this year that's really fun. So the first thing we're going to look at, so these columns here are the gross vacant land for the whole county, right? So here's the net down here in blue. This is the residual, which I call the constrained, the never to convert. And then the infrastructure portions of that. You can also see in 2004, we had an increase in land with the 2004 plan, the 2007 plan, and the 2015 plan. All those things bump it up some. 2007 was the biggie. Now, if we take a look at that, I wanted to look at, again, we want to switch now from this gross acres to net acres to what's really cool, houses, because houses you can compare to the assessor's database. How do I do that? I take those net acres of land and I multiply it times the number of housing units per net acre of land. These numbers came from the city of Battleground. You can see they have a thing called high density residential, but it's got the same density as low density. It's got the same density as mixed use. They're all six. That's the way it works. Some of these, like commercial, have zero housing units because they don't say there's any housing units happening in their commercial district or their downtown district. Over here, you can see the jobs and you can see the people per household. So this is a place where the cities get a way in on these factors and impact the model quite a bit. Now, if we look at all the cities here, we can see here's what Battlegrounds, Camas, they're all pretty similar. Clark County, who gets to do the unincorporated, the UGA of Vancouver, actually has some really reasonable densities out there that actually make more sense. So with that, if we take a look at then, here's the residential, this took that, doesn't look very different, but we went from gross net acres to now we are looking at houses. So we can see the original VBLM said there were going to be room for 54,000 additional houses. Right now we're out here, we're down to somewhere around what, 46,000 additional houses available. So now that we have houses, we can compare it to the assessor's database. So down here in blue is the assessor's database number of houses, and on top is the additional houses that the VBLM says we'll get. Now if this worked right, you'd kind of expect a step where we'd set the VBLM up, and then the blue would, the light blue would slowly consume the dark blue, right? If everything worked, this would not step up like this. It would be flat, because as you consume the dark, it would get consumed by light. We've got some weird stuff going on here. We'll go through that. So one of the ways to look at that is to look at, instead of this chart, which doesn't look too bad, let's look at the gap from this year to this year, this year to this year, and see what that looks like, because it's a lot more revealing. And that gets to looking at what's the change per year? And we can really compare then the forecast to the actuals. One of the things that is always a question is how fast does a house show up in the assessor's database? When does it show up in the vacant buildable lands model? This is a chance to look at that too. It also assumes that the vacant land converts to houses, but you know, if a vacant land converts to a park, it's not a house. So that's not a one-to-one comparison there, but that is the assumption we're going with. So again, if we go with here's the look by houses and here's the year-to-year changes, pretty wow. This is when we get those, when we add land to the vacant buildable lands model, that increases our lands, and it looks like there's negative 15,000 houses added to the map because I'm subtracting them, right? It's the bogus year because it is what it is when you're adding vacant land back into it. It increases the capacity and drops that line. So here we have the 2204 plan, the 2007 plan. Here's something that I noticed looking at this, what happened here. It turns out there's an error in the model that appeared here and started missing some of the multifamily. So that got corrected here in 2012, and then it finally stopped showing up in the data right here because when it goes down, it has to kind of go back up to compensate. And here the 2015 plan shows up. So really from here to here, some pretty good data. And we're going to go back and try and clean up some of these things. Here's the assessor's housing unit. Right off the bat, this says the assessor's housing units dropped. Assessor's housing units don't drop by 3,500 houses. That just doesn't happen. And actually, it dropped 1 year, and then it came back the next year. And when it came back, it had kind of put it back to here, add that back, so it kind of gets a whipsaw back the other way. You ask, well, where did those houses go? And the way that I do these historical assessor's databases, we save our tax lots DVD every year, and we went through and got the January data set out for all the years and went back, and it turns out in 2003, that year there was a... the assessor's database does not count units anywhere. We go and look at their data and tease out units. And there was a bug or the data went bad and we missed a lot of the multifamily units there got lost. So that's where those houses went. There's our little error. And this is cool though. This really shows the Great Recession. The assessor quit adding houses throughout the Great Recession and bang, it came back. That's kind of cool. So now we have everything in houses and we have the year to year. We can line these up and we can show the assessor compared to the model. And the green here is the delta between the two. So when the green goes way down, that means that the VBLM estimated way more houses than the assessor. So you can see every time the green line dips below the bar, the VBLM is underestimating the houses compared to the assessor. If we zoom in on the good years over here at the end, and I apologize here, I swapped the colors because I made this graph a while ago. But this one you can see the assessor housing in dark blue is far exceeding the vacant buildable lands model by 2,700 homes a year. So at this mega scale, the VBLM is not working quite as we might expect it. So let's drill down a little deeper in that and look at it by the VBLM land uses. Maybe there's one of those land uses we're not getting good. Well, look at that. The high density is really what we're missing on. Which is great because we're saying high density only has 6 units per acre, and we know that every apartment building we build has 200 units on it, right? We can see some low density that's not quite right. We also see commercial. We're underestimating the number of houses happening in commercial. Well, how's that? We didn't say any houses were going to happen in commercial in the vacant lands model, remember? Yet, if you look at downtown Vancouver here, which is all commercial city center, they're building apartment buildings everywhere, right? So your model says you're not going to have any, and you're building them there. That's a place to look. Does that make sense? Because that's a really key slide there. Okay. The next thing we can look at is by jurisdiction, which cities might be causing this problem. It's Vancouver, but that's because Vancouver is so big, right? You can see the other cities are underestimating too, so everybody could probably be doing a little changing their factors perhaps a little bit more. So we've been talking about everything at a big level, a high level. One of the questions I addressed last year was people have been asking about subdivisions, right? What's the infrastructure on subdivision? Do you have that right? So last year we went a hard look at subdivision yields. Now with this one we can see, you know, this subdivision was built. This is classified as built. The shading here shows what the land was before the subdivision was built, right before it. This one was classified as built. So the yield forecast was zero because it's already built, and yet we built another subdivision on top of it. And you can see lots of places where we have built property where they're actually able to build another subdivision. That means our underutilized is missing things, right? Our underutilized is understating things, and we're building on it. You can also see down here where there's a subdivision built on commercial. How's that happen? We changed the zoning. Okay, I did not forecast that. The lines around the different subdivisions show whether we underestimated or overestimated. And you can see, and the green ones are the ones we did pretty good on. So the blue ones, the VBLM underestimated, the red it overestimated. You can see this dark one, very constrained piece of property. We would expect the VBLM maybe to underestimate that one. All right, so that's how am I doing on time? Really good. That's how the VBLM works. And what I'd like to go to now is the work that I've been doing this year, which is really looking at all the cool tools we have in the cloud now, all these cool graphs I'm showing. They're starting to appear because the software tools are getting so much better, so much easier to use. And we're starting to show, instead of slide presentations and PDF files, we're starting to create online web resources for people to go interactively look at these results. Asking questions, where's the growth happening? Where's the remaining capacity? And one of the things we always get is the old VBLM just used to give you the spreadsheet that showed you the final numbers. And we've had requests that people wanting to see it by different areas. School districts want to know how much forecast are you forecasting by attendance area so they can do school planning, right? So, and by school district, what's happening in my school district? We've also started to do it by more logical things, and like I did the yields by city and UGA to make all of these slides. Another question, well, this is the traditional, this is all we used to give is this PDF report. So this is the new one. This is a web-based map we're showing, and what I can do is I put the vacant buildable land results in by zoning. So every zoning polygon, I've selected one here, it's got a blue dot on it that's pretty big that says that's got quite a bit of capacity. Where's the capacity? And when I clicked on it, it says it's got 832 undeveloped homes. That dropped by 132 in the last year. If I look at the assessor's side, it says there's 468 houses there, and it increased by 56 houses last year. So you can see that's a good place to go. Here's what's going on there. It's a much easier way to understand what's going on in the VBLM. It's a web map you can go look at and click on any parcels you want, or zoning. Here's the city center one I was talking about in Vancouver. You can see there's no capacity here. There's no capacity dot. Sure enough, there's no undeveloped houses. And we did add 14 houses last year. And we know there's hundreds and hundreds of houses getting added here. So that's a problem with the model right there. What's interesting, if you look at the Vancouver area, you know, that over there by the waterfront, that was vacant. Most of the other stuff that's being built in downtown Vancouver is not vacant. It's got a house, some sort of house on it. It's certainly not an acre of land, so it's not going to be underutilized. It's going to look built until it turns into an apartment. So we have a redevelopment thing we're missing there. And even if there were vacant land in here, we're not saying any houses are showing up here anyway. So lots of room for improvement, right? The other thing we've started to look at is how do we better visualize this data? One of the things I struggle with is if you want to aggregate where the vacant land is, where's the capacity, what polygons are you using to show that information, right? I showed you it by zoning. Another way I looked at it was, what if we looked at it by city block? It's kind of an interesting concept. If you're downtown here, the blocks are really small. But as you go out, the blocks get bigger and bigger as there are fewer and fewer roads. And there's fewer and fewer roads because it's kind of, is not developed yet, right? If you want to put a subdivision down, you want a piece with no roads, so roads seem like a way to constrain things and say, great, let's use that as a unit of measure. That's what I did here. These are the blocks I came up with, and then I put in the number of available houses in there based on the VBLM, and this really showed where the big chunks of vacant buildable land are, right? Where's that extra capacity out there visually? And again, it shows there's not much left in downtown Vancouver at all, or the Vancouver city limits. It's all out in the UGA and in urban holding up here. All right, so we've done a lot of things with houses. What about jobs? We're working on it. Jobs are really, really, really hard. There's so much variability in how many people work in any one space, and we just don't have anyone to tell us who's where. We get that data from the state. It's restricted, and they're really at the point they don't want to share it with us right now, so we can't get real numbers. So we're working on that. One of the goals is we have to true up. Got to find a way to get job data. What about density? Density is another requirement they're asking us to look at, because when we started down this path of the VBLM, we're supposed to have a density goal that we're achieving. We've really not been looking at density. And every time someone says density to me, I go, great, what's your unit of measure? What's your area that you're calling it? Because, you know, if we just say the whole city of Vancouver, that's great. You're throwing in Vancouver Lake as one of your areas, so that's going to lower your density. So we talk about a gross density for a city is really easy to calculate. How many housing units? How big is the city? You get that number. But I keep thinking we want to narrow in on net density. And that means what are we throwing out? Do we count parks? Do we count Vancouver Lake? Do we count the interstates, schools, public facilities? We're still researching that. I think we'll get some range of answers. One of the things we were talking about this today, and I say, you know, you can have the gross, which is easy, which is the whole city and the number of housing units. Then you can go to the other extreme and say, let's just take all the parcels that have a house on it. And how much area is that? How many people? And that's the far end in net, right? Because you're throwing out everything else.
Bob, is the state telling us how to measure these things at all?
Not at all.
Not at all.
I'm really been reading through those documents, and they talk about density, and they don't say do it this way. They really don't. So I've been reading up on density and how people do it, and this notion that your density kind of gets more general as you include the bigger areas, but
right.
Sounds like it's up to us. Much like the whole GMA is in the vacant buildable lands model, it seems a lot up to the county to make these decisions.
Okay, but we do have to document what we do and why.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, we have to document, and it's also based on the planning assumptions. If we, through our countywide planning policies, we entered into what I may call a good understanding by each of the cities that for their own share of housing, they have to have a mix. And within that mix, we expect them to have at least, for all the smaller cities, 6 units to an acre net. And then for Vancouver, I believe it's 8 overall. So when we do this work with Bob, we look at actual development that have already occurred, and then by subdivision we try to measure, okay, what are we seeing being built on the ground, and how close are we coming to Kamas achieving 6, and the other smaller cities achieving 6 units to an acre, and then this is by UGA, not by city, and then the same is true for Vancouver UGA. Are they based on actual development? Are we seeing overall both multi-family and single family up to 8 units to an acre? That's how we come back to show our work and how is that measuring up to the planning assumptions. And Matt asked a question earlier about how do we deal with schools. For schools, we put them on the public sector jobs, and there is an estimate for that during the planning horizon. So we continue to check back how close are we by looking at employment either by school district, which we have the numbers, but how much is that happening? So we have a way of measuring that when we go back 5 years later to look at how well we're doing. We are required to check back every 5 years.
And Chris, to get to your question, as much fun as I have showing all the various ways of viewing data. That's what we plan to do with density, give a range of what we found, what's the density of new subdivisions, what's the density of apartments, what's the density in the city, are things coming in as higher, what's the trends we've been seeing in density. That's what I see, a whole discussion of it so we can settle on what we want to call density from the gross to the net.
So I want to ask, the intent and purpose of doing all of this work, which is somewhat mind-numbing.
No, it's exciting.
All that is to justify, is to say to the state, this is why we need to do our room growth boundaries the way we're doing. Is that correct? What's the reason behind doing all this?
It is part of it, but it is more in the planning and sizing of your urban growth boundary. When you look at how much growth you're going to be planning for, when the council makes that decision, then we engage the cities to say, here is your share of that growth. You go plan it, you go to your own locale and come up with how you're going to manage that growth. And you use some assumptions in sizing of your urban growth boundary. In 6 units to an acre, for residential development is part of that. And that helps you, depending on that number that you're planning for, how many units do you need to accommodate that if you're doing 6 units to an acre. So that's part of the assumption that goes into the sizing of the UGB. If you're also giving number of jobs based on 20 jobs per acre, your goal is also going to say, how many acres do I then need for jobs? So you use all of that information in sizing up the UGB. 5 years later, we go back using this model to say, how well are we doing? That's part of reporting, how well is your plan working? That's kind of a checking. And then one of the other issues is what the state is calling reasonable measures. If you check in within that 5 years, time frame, and you find out that there are certain things you need to change, that's where you have a dialogue within your jurisdiction. And the county, one of the things that is in the statute is you are required to, as part of this reassessment, you are required to come up with, if I'm not meeting the density, for example, do I need to rezone some land that will help me when I look at this next land? That's what is called a reasonable measure. So they're just things that we can do, and that's one that you're asked to do before you consider expanding your boundary. Because if you're only developing at 1 unit to an acre, why? For example.
I think the next question is, right, is the if we fill up inside the UGA, then we get to expand the UGA, right? And we can... Right now we're saying it takes this much land. If we're understating the amount of houses it takes for land or overstating it, we have capacity inside the UGA still. We don't need to push the boundary out. That's what I'm saying, right? If we have capacity inside the UGA, there's no need to push the boundary out. In the past, we've kind of said that we need this much and the model says we need this much. Now the state's saying true it up and we're going, oh, it's not matching up yet, so it's going to be harder to push that urban growth boundary out. Do we try and get our model to be closer to true? I don't know.
Well, that's part of the review. How well are we doing? You know, as I indicated in here, as Bob is also saying, if you compare the model output, the assessor's data, you can see that in some cases we are overestimating. When you look at it by subdivision, you can see in some cases we are underestimated. But the goal is to come up and agree on what the capacity is at a certain time that you're looking.
So if you guys got the PowerPoint, you see I put a lot of links here from our site. And one of them is the this new site we're calling the GIS GMA Hub. And this is that cloud resource where we've added a bunch of new tools out there. You can see the old PDF files out there. You can see that subdivision story I put out there. They also have these really cool dashboards out here that make it much, much easier to look at the data. We also presented all this stuff to the city, and this is kind of an interactive PowerPoint I went through with the folks in the city. We're just sharing most of the stuff out on the web now and putting a big draft on it so people can look at it. I think we have a slow computer here. This is usually pretty fast. So with this one, I can pick a city here. You can pick these cities and you can see the charts are changing. And what they're showing us is this is the gross acres, the net acres. Here's the housing units. For 2019, you can see there's a 1,200 housing units in Le Center. And you can see there's 246 in the UGA and 1,200 inside the city limits. Down here, you can actually see the breakdown by the different land uses. And, you know, you can actually, it's kind of neat. If you click on the different cities, you can see the different land uses they have for their where their capacity is landing in. Battleground's an interesting one because they've got a lot of different land uses. Most everybody's sticking it all in low density. But these are some great resources over here, those maps I talked about. Where's the capacity? You can see those numbers. It looks better on a high-res screen than this. Up here's the commercial one. Then down here, there's a bunch of maps. You can see the residential results, which is that same map, right? And then you can also see the commercial results. You can see the VBLM classifications. There is so much fun stuff out here. So back in my presentation, there's the hub, and then there's direct links to some of the stuff I've shown. The housing study one is on a kind of a different server, so this has a weird link to get to it, but it is there. These basically have the same charts I cut and pasted from this screen, actually, to put into my talk. So you can actually go in here and look at these charts, click on them, click around. You can turn things on and off, so if you go, oh, that's... kind of cool. It's worthwhile going around and playing with that stuff and see what it does. One of the questions I'm putting out there for people is to please explore this stuff and let me know you're using it. If not, which of these resources help you? What do you want to see? We can get that out there for you. Which of those rebel resources help you? Please give me some feedback on this stuff. It's very rewarding to know people look at this besides me. That's pretty much my talk. Are there any other questions or web resources you like?
Robin, you want to spend a couple hours on this with us before you go? You want to spend a couple hours on this before you go? Just for fun.
We'll fix it tonight.
On your own time.
Well, the final thing I would add is that, as Bob indicated, the state, through a bill that the legislature passed and the governor signed, I think it's Senate Bill 52-54, the state amended or updated the guidelines for the buildable lands review and report. So that new guidelines require us to take another look at our model and make sure that as we do this the next time, that we incorporate those new guidelines and factors that they want us to consider. So we are going to be doing that, and the report is due to the state June 30, 2021. This will be the first time the county is using a consultant to help us take a look at our model and indicate that, well, we prepare our report and send it to the state that we are meeting that guideline. So some of you, I think, have reached out to the planning. We don't know yet. So stay tuned. I may come back to the chair and ask as I work with the council and particularly the county manager to put a project advisory group to help us make sure that A, our model is up to standard, and two, that when we put out this report that is due to the state, that we incorporate all the new things that are in the new guideline. So stay tuned. This is the model that we use to establish what is the capacity within the urban growth boundaries of all the cities that we are planning with. And it is also, I will say that we've had issues, but it is one where there's always a challenge because we want to come to a point where we can all agree, not only staff, but our cities, the business community, and everyone else that has is a stakeholder to agree on what the capacity is before we do our next plan update. So this is really the foundation to establish that capacity. So we're not debating whether we're overestimating or underestimating. And part of that is when we update the comprehensive plan, go through the periodic update, you are the first body that sees that and make recommendation to the council. Part of that recommendation, you're going to be talking about what does the VDL say and how are we using it to help and work with the cities in the sizing of the urban growth boundary. Bob mentioned earlier about infrastructure set aside. It is an area that we said, you know, the state is also telling us, you just don't go make an assumption or make things up. It's going to be based on facts and actual development and not on hypothetical. So that's why we go back and say, okay, let's look at what I've developed. There are new regulations that have come on board, like the stormwater, for example. So we can do pre-stormwater regulation and post-stormwater regulation. What are we still seeing? So this is the mechanism for us to capture that.
Mr. Mina?
No, this isn't
the
meeting.
Good to see you all.
See you.
So if you don't have any more questions for Bob, this is it. I know Steve, I've seen this many times, as well as Don Merkel, so this is for the new, you've seen it before. I don't know whether you've seen this before.
No.
And Rick,
no.
And Matt, so this is for your benefit. When we have someone, a consultant on board, and as we are working with them, we will have an opportunity to provide you updates.
All right, well, thank you very much. We have a hearing next door, and I need to use the facilities. So I think with that, we will adjourn and move next door. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
So, Bob?